So how's your falsetto, Glyn? How's it coming along?
My falsetto.
Yes, because you
I can categorically say I don't have one.
Well, you need to get one, don't you? If we're going to do that reenactment of Wuthering Heights on Sibri Hill.
Well, actually, I thought you could do the falsetto and I'd do the dancing.
All right, you're on. Have you got a red dress?
I'm sure I've got one tucked away somewhere for my weekend wardrobe.
Yeah. Do you think we should explain what we're talking about?
I think so.
So somebody put on the Facebook group a picture of, well, it might even be a video clip of Kate Bush performing Wuthering Heights, which was about 150 years ago, I think. And apparently it was filmed on, or that bit was filmed on Sibri Hill, which is near Tidworth, isn't it?
So, yeah, and the thing is, I really like that song, and I've watched that video about 100 times, and I never realised it was local.
I must admit, I can't bear the bloody song, but there you go. But I do like Kate Bush a lot, but it's just that one. Anyway, that's our next challenge.
Okay, welcome to another Hidden Wiltshire podcast where we talk about things in Wiltshire that are mostly hidden from sight. My name is Glyn Coy and I, amongst other things, take photographs of Wiltshire and put them on the internet. And with me this week I have, as always...
Paul Timlett. I'm going to give up with all the photographer stuff, the creative artist, and I'm just a photographer.
Paint with light.
I paint with light. I'm a visual artist. I'm a creative. God, I hate that word as well. But yeah, take photographs. Live in Wiltshire.
So it's good. We've got this hobby of doing long walks and taking photographs and combining them and sort of sharing them with people is what's kickstarted this whole thing. And now we're podcast hosts as well.
So episode 10. Can you believe
episode
it?
Episode 10.
Double figures. How did that happen?
I don't know. Time flies, though, doesn't it? But it's been a lot of fun. I've quite enjoyed doing it, and I'm really pleased that the feedback has been so positive. So one or two people at least like it anyway.
Yeah. I must admit, when we started, I thought, well, you know, I give it sort of three or four, and then we'll get bored with it. But no, I think we're sort of in our stride now, and looking forward to the next 10.
Yeah, there's so much to do, though. I mean, this is a funny thing, is that even though we've done 10, we're only really scratching the surface of Wiltshire. There's plenty more to unearth as we move forward. So, yeah, looking forward to it. So the last couple of weeks have been quite interesting. And they seem to be dominated by a certain colour.
And I've had enough of it. I'm sick of the things.
So we are deep into and coming to the end, really, of bluebell season. And actually, it's been a fantastic year for bluebells. I don't know what's been going on, but the colours out there have been amazing.
I think I mentioned before, I've got some in my garden, which a neighbour gave me. And I should have known better at the time, but she's a lovely neighbour. Her name's Paz. She's from Madeira. And she gave me these bluebells, which she dug out of her garden. She said, oh, I've got far too many and they're taking over. And she gave them to me in pots months ago. And she said, just put them where you intend to plant them. Just leave them there in the pots. And when they start to flower, put them in. So I put them in and I thought, they look a bit of a funny colour because they started to bloom now. They look a bit of an odd colour and they're quite small. And I thought, oh, God, I really hope they're not what I think they are. So I used one of my plant ID apps, and guess what? They're Spanish bluebells.
Oh no!
Before you know it, they'll be everywhere. They'll be in Trowbridge. They'll be spreading up. They're spreading up to you.
Oh dear! You deserve to be arrested for that, introducing a foreign species into the ecosystem.
It's
like
not
that.
My fault. It was Paz. So, but being sort of Portuguese, I should have known that they were from kind of that part of the continent.
Yeah.
But they're still very pretty. So.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, the bluebells have been really good. And I think you and I have both been out there exploring. Because actually, one thing that people probably don't realise is Bluebells are really difficult to photograph well.
Yeah, yeah.
Because when you look at the things with your naked eye, it looks fabulous, and the colours merge in, and it creates this sort of illusion of a carpet of colour. But trying to translate that onto the camera to do it justice is really quite difficult.
Yeah, it's very hard. It's I mean, I think part of it is sort of, I was explaining this to my son the other day, that sort of dynamic range. So with a camera can only see a certain amounts from sort of pure black to pure white. It can only see a relatively compressed spectrum of tones. And unlike our eye, where you can sort of look into a really bright white sky and into deep shadows and you can see both. Well, a camera can't. So it compresses all the tones and the colours. You're right, sort of. So when you're in a wood, so I posted some pictures of gopher wood, which was just spectacular, as were some of the others. But I went early morning. I mean, I was up there for, I think I got into gopher wood about 6:30 in the morning, and the sun was really low, sort of shining through the trees. So the sort of, you know, the range of darks to, you know, shadows to brightness was really extreme. So getting those pictures balanced was very, very difficult. And then trying to get the right sort of shades of blue. And in fact, when I was processing it, and I've started to put some photographic notes in the captions of my photographs to say, you know, how I've got what I've got. And I've kind of given up trying to get a genuine colour, and I get something that actually looks more appealing to my eye anyway. And of course, we all see colours in different ways. So they do take some fairly heavy processing. So, you know, if you go up to gopher wood and say, well, why don't those bluebells look like the ones I saw in those photographs? You know, that's the reason why. But I think we're done now, aren't we? We're done with bluebells.
Yeah, I'm sick of the sight of them. I'm joking. No, yeah. But I think they are coming to an end. So it's probably, if you're going to get out there and take some photos, I think really it's the next week or so that you need to be getting out there and doing that, because I don't think they're going to last much longer. They're at their best at the moment.
Yeah. And of course, orchids are starting to appear now. I've seen some great orchid photos from in Wiltshire from... from Melanie May, who we mentioned last week, who's Wiltshire Girl on Instagram, her and Wayne Ford, posting some really beautiful orchid shots at the moment.
Yeah, I've seen some early purple orchids.
Have you?
Around this neck of the woods, yeah, in Green Lane Wood, which is on the outskirts of Trowbridge. I saw some there. They always come up early in the same spot in the wood.
Yeah.
I spotted them about a week ago, so they're usually the first ones to come through. So that's the next thing to look forward to, is the orchid season. Yeah.
I've got a couple of days on Parsonage Down at the Nature Reserve next week, so I'm going to go onto what's called Parsonage Bank, where there's just huge numbers of orchids up there at the right time of year, where you and I went last year.
Yeah, I remember we both took a trip over there to do that and spent the day pretty much photographing orchids.
On our hands and knees again.
On our hands and knees, yeah. And we were having debates over, was this a particular type of orchid or is that? What does my app say versus what does our local guy say? And it was quite funny. But there are some quite rare ones up there. But we can talk about that when they come out
when
a bit more
detail.
Yeah.
And you started in newsletter as well.
Yeah, I did. I thought, because we're so spread across different media, so we've got the Facebook page, which I guess we can just talk about now. We do have two Facebook locations. One is the Facebook page, where we just post stuff and you can go and have a look. And if you follow it or you like it, you can see the stuff that gets posted. And we put most of the stuff up there that we're up to. But we also have a Facebook group, which is closed. And we like that to be a bit more interactive. So we have some sort of questions that you have to answer before you get in, just to demonstrate that you understand that, you know, it's not just a place to come and look at stuff. We like people to be interactive and post their own photos up there and, you know, have some discussions going. So if that's not your, doesn't float your boat, stick with the page. You'll see everything you can want to see there. But if you do want to get more interactive and involved in stuff that we're up to and contribute, then the Facebook group is a place for you. But do answer the questions, because some people apply to come in and then don't answer the questions and then can't get let in.
But I think it's, you know, some people see the questions and think, oh, no, that's not for me, and then they sort of exit out again, which is fine. But we can see that you've kind of gone in. So we tend to just sort of leave those for a few days, and then, well, Facebook just removes them eventually. But
You've got a couple of days, to come back in and answer the questions. But after a couple of days, you just won't be let in. It will just get deleted or whatever. But yeah, so those are the two things. We've also, Paul and I have both got Instagram pages where we post our stuff. I've got a Twitter account where I post stuff. But because this is all spread out all over the place and I've got different people looking at different things, I thought one thing that would help unify everything that we do in terms of the messaging would be a newsletter. So I created a newsletter, and hundreds of people signed up to receive it, which I was quite surprised at. So it went out to over 400 email addresses.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So, the newsletter is something I'm going to bring out every week, which will just have a brief summary of what we've been doing, just to let people know about podcast updates and things like that, and also show the online shop, which we're using to kind of not get rich but just have enough income to keep things
nice.
Ticking over, keep the lights on with the website and the podcast. And in the online shop we've got prints, postcards, greetings cards, t-shirts, actually Hidden Wiltshire t-shirts, which a few people have bought. Obviously it's not really t-shirt weather at the moment, but hopefully that will change quite soon. And also, I'm now selling a digital copy of the Hidden Wiltshire book. So a couple of years ago, well, 3 years ago, I brought out a hardback book of Hidden Wiltshire, which was really well received. And it was so well received, it sold out. And I decided not to do a reprint and actually move on to do a Hidden Wiltshire second book, which we'll get onto at some point. But I'm selling the original book, digital copies of that, for £6.99 on the website as well. So have a look. If it's something that interests you, you're more than welcome to purchase anything in there. But you know, obviously, as with all these things, it's totally up to you. There's no pressure or obligation at all.
So the digital book, I must admit, I haven't looked because I've got the hardback version. But how do the photographs appear in the digital version? You have to look at it on a big screen or
it's on a big
tablet.
Screen.
Yeah.
So it's a PDF. So you can look at it on a tablet or you can look at it on a computer screen. The pictures translate really well onto the screen. They're very high quality. The size of the file is quite large. It doesn't compress anything. So it's a good representation. From my perspective, it's not as good as having a physical book in your hand, but because the book's not available now and the book, you know, was selling at over £20, I thought this is a good good middle ground of letting people access to what was produced at a reasonable price.
I think so many of us sort of stare at these tiny screens, we consume our sort of imagery, you know, photographs and things on a little whatever, a phone screen measures. But to see them on a big screen. In fact, I was looking at some of the photographs, the ones that you're selling, particularly the Bluebell Wood one the other day. And it's the first time I've actually looked at it on, granted it was only on my 15-inch laptop. I thought, wow, you know, I can see detail in this. I just never noticed before when I was looking at it on my phone.
It's funny you should say that, because that's the other thing I've noticed, is actually looking at the prints in hand. And they're not huge prints, 8x6, but actually having the physical print in your hand brings a level of detail out that you just don't see looking on a small screen. So the prints look absolutely fantastic in a frame. It just allows you to look at the photographs in a different light and have a focus and attention to them that you don't normally get when you're just scrolling through and clicking the like button or whatever.
Yeah, being old-fashioned, I sort of, in terms of photography anyway, I think, you know, the process hasn't finished until you've done the print. You know, it doesn't just end with the thing on the screen which you post on social media. And obviously, you know, I don't print everything. I print my own, but I don't print everything I take. It's an expensive process. So I sort of reserve it for the photographs that I think I'm really happy with. Then I'll print those out. And
that's the thing.
That's the end of the process, you know.
Yeah. I've got 4 years worth of photos from Hidden Wiltshire, and out of that 4 years, I've chosen 8. And probably about half of those I already had printed off for myself and in frames around my house. The pictures that I personally think, you know, represent the best of what I've been able to find out there.
Yeah.
But it does make a difference having the, like you say, the final product in your hands.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. Walk time.
So we better
isn't
get
it?
On with. Yeah. We better get on with what we were actually here to talk about, which is Font Hill.
Yes.
Right, so yes, this week our podcast is going to focus on the Font Hill estate. Now, a few weeks ago, I did a walk, a circular walk that took this estate in. It was about 6 miles circular walk, started at the top end of the lake and went in the surrounding countryside. And it was a walk that I discovered from the Visit Wiltshire website. And I've been meaning to do it for a long time, but never got around to it. But I'd driven through past Font Hill Lake a few times and found it a really beautiful place, very picturesque. But I thought, no, I'm going to find the time to stop and actually do this walk. And I think you did it the week later, didn't you, Paul?
Yeah, I did it. Well, I'll tell you when I did it, the day that we were allowed to go to the pub. Because,
yes, when the pub was open.
It was open. And I actually sat in the garden with another walking chum of mine, Julia, as opposed to Stu. We sat in the garden and had a pint, which was just amazing.
So tell everyone, which pub was that? Was that the...
It was the... what's it called? I forgot what it's called.
Was it the Beckford Arms?
Beckford Arms, yes, thank you.
Staring
at the name Beckford on my notes here. Well, the Beckford Arms. But we started the walk in somewhere different. We started at Font Hill... Font Hill Bishop in the village,
right? Yep.
So the Beckford was halfway round, whereas you started at
just
the pub,
the road
we?
From yes. the pub. So that wouldn't have been a good start to the walk if I'd sat in there.
Actually, do you actually get any further than the pub? All those photographs you posted were taken from Visit Wiltshire.
Yeah, I know. Actually, the pub was closed when I was there.
It was literally
it was literally the week or so before the pubs were allowed to open again. So yeah, it was very much closed. And
as we got up to it, I mean, this will come later on, but in your walk. But as we got up to it, it's halfway around. I was sort of thinking to myself, oh God, please, I just hope the pub is open. And outside, it was just a great sign. You know, they put sort of board outside. Quite often, it's a black board outside of a pub. And, you know, whatever is going on. And all it said was pint, ? And I thought, yes. Where do I sign? So that was
brilliant.
It.
yeah. But yeah, I started this walk at the... I kind of went from the top end of the Font Hill Lake by Font Hill Bishop and drove all the way to the far end. And the road then moves away from the lake. And just before you exit that sort of estate area, you can park on the left-hand side of the road. And I came out of there and literally across the road was the pub. And actually, it gave rise to that name, Beckford. Because the Beckford name is very strongly associated with this part of the world.
Yeah.
And actually doing the research about why was an absolute joy, because it was fascinating to find out about this character, William Beckford.
Yeah.
From the 1700s, who owned the... I think he inherited the estate, didn't he? From his father. Or did he buy it?
Yes, no, he did. Because we were swapping lots of notes about this yesterday, weren't we? I wrote a whole page of notes about the sort of history of the... Really about the sort of Beckford family and how they came to be in at Font Hill, and I mean, you and I were sort of messaging each other as we turned up even more extraordinary facts about these people. The Beckfords, they got their money from, as did a lot of very sort of wealthy families who are still around these days, from slavery. William Beckford's ancestors they ran plantations in Jamaica, I think it was Colonel Peter Beckford bought some land, a plantation in Jamaica from Charles Drax, and of course this is in 1715, and of course that's the Drax as in Richard Drax, who's the current the latest in line of that family. He's a Conservative MP down in Dorset, who's famously owns the longest wall in the UK, I think, past the Drax estate. So Colonel Peter Beckford had this sort of plantation, which he then handed on to his son, also Peter Beckford. Charles Beckford. Was it Peter? Oh, God, I don't know. I was getting so confused because everybody has the same...
They all have the same name, don't they?
Yeah, they don't only inherit land and fortunes. They inherit names as well.
Yeah.
So I think, yes, it was Colonel Peter Beckford kind of started it all. And he was also described as a buccaneer, sort of a bit of a pirate. So he handed it on to his son, Peter. And then his son, Peter... had a son called William. William then had a son called, guess what? William.
William.
And it was that William, so the great grandson of Colonel Peter Beckford, who ended up inheriting Font Hill.
But he was young, wasn't he, when he inherited it?
He was 18 when he inherited it.
Yeah, so he's a millionaire at 18. Yeah, multi-millionaire.
Yes, and the thing I was reading said this was the largest estate or real estate in terms of the possessions and, you know, everything else that went along with it. It was the largest real estate in Europe, and he was 18 when he inherited this.
So he's 18. He's inherited the largest estate in Europe.
Yes, yeah.
He probably never has to work for the rest of his life.
No.
I think he wanted to make a name for himself. I heard that he wanted to get into politics or something like that. But then there was a scandal which destroyed his social standing.
Yeah. Well, he got married in 1783, and he married Lady Margaret Gordon, and. And you know, sort of had this sort of air of sort of respectability, or if that's not a too much of a derogatory word, but and anyway, he was allegedly caught by somebody looking through a keyhole, basically up to things that he in those days were frowned upon with the son of the Earl of Devon. So I think we'll kind of leave it at that.
Yeah, the thing is, those such things that were frowned upon were quite serious back then.
They were very serious.
You could get into a terrible lot of trouble if you were a practicing homosexual in those days.
Yes. Yeah.
Now they were caught, well, obviously having this assignation, and then I think somebody wrote an article about it in the Times disparaging his character.
Yes, he was. So basically, his reputation was sort of destroyed. Deciding to do the right thing or the wrong thing or whatever, or thinking he was doing the right thing. So he fled the country with his wife, who by this time was pregnant. And they had two children. And whilst they were living, I can't remember, they're living, is it France or Spain, something like that, or maybe Italy, she died. And William Beckford eventually returned to England with these two children. Together with a young man called Gregorio Franchi, who is the son of an Italian court singer. But also, this is extraordinary bit. He also returned with a Spanish dwarf named Pero.
Now, this Spanish dwarf, this story tickled me because I found reference in The Guardian to this. And apparently, when he was back in Fonthill and living in the place, Pero became his doorman. And he used to dress him in a suit of gold. So
that's
this
right.
gold-suited dwarf would answer the door and shield him from visitors who would try and make their way over across Fonthill, because Fonthill became quite famous because he was a tremendous collector of art. He was using his fortune to buy loads and loads of different works of art across Europe, which were then pulled together and into his home in Fonthill. So much so that he had to build an abbey to house them.
Yeah, I mean, he built this incredible, well, I was going to say, use the word folly, but that's exactly what it was. And it was, I think people described it as Beckford's folly or whatever. He just sort of went on this spending spree, which included the building of the time was the longest or the largest wall in England. So whether Drax has sort of outdone him, I don't know. But apparently that was 8 miles long and 12 feet high, this wall. Because basically, you know, he's with his reputation that was shot to pieces. He basically locked himself away. And as you say, he sort of embarked on this spending spree.
But as well as the wall, I'd read as elsewhere that first of all, he built the wall to keep fox hunters out
and people, yes.
but he also laid man traps,
yes,
and apparently trained bloodhounds to deter sightseers. So if you ever got to the door to see Pero in his gold suit, you might have had your foot in a man trap and you might have been chased by bloodhounds, but you would have had to be very tenacious to get to the front door of Beckford's Folly.
Yes, we were saying to each other yesterday, what a guy.
It's just unbelievable.
But it made me remember, or it reminded me of a book which I'd mentioned in a previous podcast by a local Wiltshire author, a guy called Nick Cohen, and it's a work of fiction called the Complete Adventures of Henry Chalk, Pedestrian Tourist, and it was a trilogy when I bought it, but I gather it's now been combined into a single book. These sort of, you know, William Beckford and Pero are all sort of weaved into the book, and I didn't realise that Pero, you know, the Spanish dwarf, was actually a real person. I just thought it was a figment of Nick Cohen's imagination.
So he was basing it on reality.
Yeah, absolutely.
I tell you what, this would make a brilliant film. Oh, someone should make this into a movie, because you couldn't make this up.
Well, anybody who's met me will put me in the role of the dwarf. But
yeah. But the funny thing is, after he'd I think he'd reached the point where he got bored of his collection and bored of Fonthill, so he sold it and started selling off some of his art.
Yeah.
And moved to Bath.
And I shared that quote with you yesterday. There was an essayist called William Hazlitt, who was a friend of John Keats, the poet, and his description of the collection and of the folly was just fantastic. And I'll read this out. He described it as a desert of magnificence, a glittering waste of laborious idleness, a cathedral turned into a toy shop, an immense museum of all that is most curious and costly and at the same time worthless. The only proof of taste he has shown in the collection is he's getting rid of it. Oh, that's just fantastic, isn't it?
But he didn't get rid of it all, because he eventually moved to Bath and he bought houses along Lansdowne Crescent. And actually, further up Lansdowne Road, he built another tower up there, which is still standing, Beckford's Tower. It's now a museum. It houses a lot of his old art, I think, whatever was left. And he created a ride as well. So from his house in Lansdowne Crescent, he could ride his horse up to the tower and go up there and survey the scene. And apparently he was a bit fed up because it was about 40 feet too short. So he wanted it to be a little bit higher because the view wasn't quite good enough. The view was designed to purposely not take in the city of Bath, which he didn't want to see. He wanted to look out over the surrounding countryside.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And there's an extraordinary character. And this colourful life built on these millions and millions of pounds worth of money that he inherited in today's money.
Well, I suppose these days he'd be a billionaire, I would think.
Yeah, billionaire. I mean, he literally lived the life of Riley. I mean, he could do whatever he wanted. But it was, he didn't seem to have any conscience about the fact that the money came from where it did, this the slave plantations of Jamaica. It's
I mean, in those days, there were so many of them. I mean, they all sort of, you know, a lot of them flocked back to England.
yeah.
I mean, you know, his ancestors, you know, the Charles, sorry, not Charles, I keep calling him Charles Peter Beckford. I mean, they were born in Jamaica and sort of, you know, part of society there. But I think with all this money that they'd acquired and I guess wanting to get some sort of air of respectability, they moved to England and you know, they started buying up estates and building
Yeah.
mansions. And in at that time when the Beckfords came to England, around that sort of period, apparently there was something like 300 new manor houses were built
Yeah.
In England with the money from plantations and slavery.
But sadly, going back to Font Hill, Beckford's Folly, or the Font Hill Abbey that was built to house his collection, had a huge tower. And a couple of years after he'd sold it and gone to Bath, the tower collapsed because he'd done it in such a rush and pressured the builders to get it up so quickly that the thing was literally built on sand.
Yeah, there was no
And
foundations.
no, so there were no foundations and it did collapse. And whatever was left was kind of, you know, repurposed into, I think there's a more modern version of Font Hill Abbey, but it's all closed off to the public. You can't go and wander up to what's left anymore. So yeah, just like he built his wall and man traps, they
Yeah.
still don't want people to go and visit the abbey.
But I read they actually a really good source of sort of the history of the, you know, the estate and what have you is the Font Hill Estate's own website.
Yes.
So there's a good sort of history page on there, and I was reading that yesterday, and they were saying that talking about William Beckford, who apparently sold the estate in 1823 to a guy called John Farquhar. Sounds like something from Shrek, doesn't it?
It does, Lord Farquhar.
Yeah, speaking of dwarfs, who was a gunpowder contractor from Bengal, because apart from the slave owners coming back, a lot of people who sort of part of the East India Company were also coming back to England and hoovering up great chunks of the country. But within 2 years of selling it, I think that's when the abbey fell down. So it's when Farquhar owned it, and he tried to sell it, or sell the estate, and he died in 1826. And I think by this point there was only sort of a bit of the property left of the original sort of folly, they called the Pavilion, which he gave to his nephew, a guy called George Mortimer, who then sort of enlarged the house, built a woolen mill at the end of the lake, and I think there's still sort of evidence of that now. And then just sort of completing the story really, Mortimer tried to sell it as well, and obviously couldn't sell it, and a family, and this is where we complete the circle, the Morrison family. It sounds like they spent their summer holidays there. Mortimer rented the estate out to the Morrisons in the summer of 1829, and according to the Font Hill Estate website, they had the holiday was so successful, not quite sure what that means, that the Morrisons bought the estate. So next time you go to your rental accommodation in your holiday accommodation in Cornwall and you have a successful holiday, just buy the accommodation.
Yes, and that was bought in, I think, 1830, wasn't it, when the
Yes.
Morrisons bought it. And actually, the Morrison family still own it today.
That's right. Hence the completing the circle.
Yes, so the current owner is it's Alistair Morrison, who's the third Lord Margadown.
Yes. Of Islay. So it's Lord
Yes,
My,
so he's got,
as in the Scottish Island.
yeah, so they've got land up there as well. So, I mean, the estate is enormous.
Yes.
Font Hill, and
It did.
obviously the Morrisons over years have expanded it.
Yeah. It did make me smile though. It said, my notes here said, by 1844, the Font Hill Park estate had ceased to be ceased to be Morrison's main country home. Yeah, so James Morrison, who lived in it, so by 1844 it ceased to be his main country home, because he bought Basildon Park in Berkshire because Fonthill was too far from London. So one country yard's estate's not enough. It's
Oh, this one's too far. Let's just buy one a bit closer.
Just buy another
London.
One. Yeah.
Different world, different Absolutely. Times. But
the current house. We were talking about this sort of the place falling down, but apparently the current house, I think, is the sixth version of it. So yes. The five previous ones have basically fallen down or been demolished.
Yes. Yeah. But I think one thing I found, I was going to say, is the estate, you know, is very well managed today. I mean, one thing you'll discover as you're walking on this walk is you're walking on mostly the Fonthill estate, and it's all very manicured and very well kept. You do get the impression you are walking on a country estate. It's not like a normal country walk in Wiltshire. But to my mind, that kind of adds to the intrigue about it, because there are all sorts of weird things around there. And the rights of way are very clearly marked, but the places where you're not supposed to go are also clearly marked with lots of privacy signs. And there are little things around the lake. There are grottos around the lake, which...
Caves up in the woods.
Yeah, and most of those are kind of in places you're not supposed to go. But some people do. I've seen some pictures on the internet that people have taken as they've gone to those places. But it's an intriguing place.
Yeah.
Very intriguing. And the history just adds to the colour, really.
Yeah, and it goes on. I mean, the current sort of owners of the estate are sort of... interesting family. I think they're sort of related to the Mitford sisters. Five, six Mitford sisters in the. So the one of the daughters or the daughter of the current owner is named Nancy, and obviously there was a Nancy Mitford. So again, we've got this theme of the names sort of transferring across the generations. But it made me smile because they got into a bit of trouble back in, I think it was 2016, where there's a lot of complaints from the neighbours, the neighbours being in Tisbury, because they'd had a party for the daughter's 21st birthday, and it went on all night, and people in Tisbury were complaining. So it even hit all the national papers, all reporting this great scandal, and... Poor old Alistair Morrison had to apologise to him. But it did tickle me, because apparently William Beckford also had a big party going back all those, hundreds of years.
Yes.
He had his 21st birthday at Fonthill, but he's went on for 3 days. So I think Nancy let the side down there.
Oh, dear. It's funny. Here we are supposed to be talking about a walk, and we spent most of our time talking about scandal and history and characters. But
fantastic.
So let's get back to this walk.
Yeah,
so, what I did is just past the pub, I carried on walking up a lane to the side of it, which went past the church in Fonthill Gifford. And then you go across some fields, across to the top edge of the village. It was funny, I was stood at the edge of the wood, looking down the road to Fonthill Gifford village. And in the far distance, it was peaceful. It was quiet. You felt like you're in a very picturesque place. But just on the brow of the hill in the distance, I could see the A303.
Yeah.
And these lorries thundering on their way down to Cornwall. So you're not that far away from civilization in reality.
No, that's right. Actually, a bit back from there, because I went to have a look at the church, which is an incredible looking church. I mean, it's huge. Bear in mind that, the village itself is almost nothing there. So this is Fonthill Gifford, isn't it? Which is where the pub is, where the Beckford Arms. So the church is just, 50 metres down the road from the Beckford Arms. Unfortunately, it was closed, but it's an extraordinary shape. But right next to it was there's a vineyard. And I was looking at this and I thought, it doesn't look as though it's operational. It doesn't look as though anybody's growing anything there. And I put on the Facebook page a photograph of it, and a great big house, the far side of the vineyard. And I couldn't identify this house. And I said something about the vineyard, saying, it looks a bit unkempt. And somebody posted or put a comment on the Facebook group saying that the vines are still tended, and apparently they've just been doing something to them. They've been tying them up or whatever they were doing, and that the house is actually the old rectory, which I did a bit of sort of digging around that, and it looks like that was bought a few years ago by somebody from London who made his fortune buying and selling stuff, and has bought the rectory and spent a couple of million quid doing it up, or buying it and doing it up, and it's now a very grand house. But somebody also, because I was curious about the vineyards, because I can remember the Fonthill Glebe Winery, and I googled that, and it looked to me like it's closed down. There was just, the website was doesn't exist anymore. I couldn't find any sort of reference to it anymore. So I'm not really sure what they're doing with those vines. They're clearly they're tending them again, and they're intending to grow grapes. So have they just restarted the winery? I don't know. I'd love to find out, because it used to be a very good wine apparently, and maybe still is if it's still being produced.
Yeah. I tell you what, though, if that's a rectory, it looked like a mansion.
It was huge.
It was massive.
Yeah.
Well, that's a great job if you can land becoming the vicar of that church, and if you've got that building.
That's where the money was.
Yeah. So, yeah, so going back to Fonthill Gifford itself, the village, when I dropped down into it, I noticed, did you see the village hall there that looked like a wooden shack?
Yeah.
It turns out that was an old World War One hut that had been requisitioned or lifted and shifted from somewhere.
It's World War One or World War Two?
World War One.
One, okay.
Yeah. Well, it's funny, I went back and I put it on Twitter and had some military types point out. I think it's John Gretsch on the Facebook page pointed out, and he's a military building expert as well. He said he thought it was World War One. So right. I put it on Twitter, and then I got confirmation from this Twitter account. I think it's called World War One Huts. they confirmed it was a World War One hut. So obviously it had been located nearby, and once it was no longer needed, the village lifted and shifted it to that location, and it still looks in working order.
But that village, is that Fonthill Gifford? It was like Greenwich. I think it's called Greenwich if you look at the map.
Well, if you look on the map, Greenwich is a little bit further north of there. So Fonthill Gifford is both that road where the World War One hut is, and it stretches all the way down to the pub at the other end. It's like a triangle. Because at the end of the village, there was like a sort of junction of roads and a phone box.
Yeah.
And directly ahead, I could see a farm that was called Stop Farm.
Yeah.
That was where you get that curious house that looks like it's been chopped in half.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go and have a look at it. And I've got a photo on the website. So you, by the way, you can look at all this walk on the website and see the pictures. But there is a building that with a thatch on that literally looks like it's been sliced in half.
Yeah.
But just past Stop Farm was a track. That I think it was the road was called Greenwich or something, but it led you to
where the phone box is. That street is Stop Street,
right?
And then at the end, obviously, you've got Stop Farm.
Yeah, and then behind Stop Farm, you've got a row of houses which is called Greenwich.
Ah, right. Okay, that's
so. I think that's that row of houses is like a small hamlet called Greenwich, because then you go over the top through what's called the terraces, which is a steep hill with trees on to go over the top of onto the next ridge, and then beyond where you drop down into the very curious village of Berwick St Leonard.
But to get to up the terraces, this is another case of you walking in somebody's garden, aren't you?
You are, and I had to stop again and think, oh, is this the right path? But yeah, the path takes you right round the outside of someone's garden and up into the terraces. So yeah, another curious right of way.
But but Berwick St Leonard is very weird, isn't it?
Well, yeah, because it's on the map, it looks like a normal village, and it's got it's got a name, it's got a church marked on it. So you think you're going to drop down into a normal village. But when I drop down to the road, the first thing I was scratching my head about was, how'd you get into this village?
Yeah.
There was no obvious entry point. And then once I found a way to get in, I suddenly realised it looked more like an estate office than a village.
It looked an industrial estate to me.
Yeah, the first set of buildings were actually industrial. And beyond that, there seemed to be some sort of a farm that looked like, the Fonthill Estate offices or some sort.
I couldn't even see the church initially.
Yeah.
So when you get down to that road, which you've got to get across to get over to the village, I mean, Julia and I were sort of walking up and down this road thinking, how the hell do we get from here to where we think the church is? Because I could see
Yes.
the church on my map, but I couldn't see it from the road.
Yeah.
And we were sort of walking up and down, and eventually we saw a lady sort of come up from our right. So we're facing sort of facing the road and the church somewhere on the other side, and the lady sort of came along the footpath from our right, and I said, have you just come from Berwick St Leonard? And she sort of looked at me as I was mad and said, well, yes. And so I said, well, how'd you get in? How'd you get there? And we sort of, so basically, as you come down the hill and you've got the road across in front of you, you have to turn right. So we tried going left and walking up the road to the left because we could see a driveway up to a farm, but apparently you go right. And I think from memory there was a letterbox, there was a post box on the main road, and there's a sort of driveway which looks like an entrance to an industrial estate by that letterbox, and that's where this lady had come out. So we sort of walked down into there, and then lo and behold, we could see the church.
Yeah, and it was a nice little church actually. It
Oh, I
was
thought the church was super. Loved it.
it actually it's it, it as I walked in, it was very welcoming. You know, there
Yeah.
was signs saying come in, and it's a church that's now managed by the Church's Conservation Trust.
That's right, yeah.
Who actually, interestingly, after I'd visited there and I'd seen a couple of other churches run or managed by them in Wiltshire lately, it inspired me to go and actually sign up to join them.
Oh, that's a good idea, yeah.
So I just thought I'd give them a little bit of, you know, funding, not a huge amount to join, but just to show my support really for what they do and keep these little churches alive really in Wiltshire. There's quite a lot of
Yeah.
them in the county.
Well, we've got one here just up the road from where I live, Rolston Church, which is on the edge
Yeah.
of Shrewton, which is a beautiful little church. Really sort of, I'll say beautiful. It's very rustic, and it's been sort of fairly poorly patched up in places over the years, but it's just such a peaceful place, and that's maintained by the trust as well. So yeah, worthy cause.
Yeah, definitely.
But yes, the church was interesting. In fact, I posted some photographs, which became the victim of the Facebook crash, didn't it? Facebook deleted a load of posts going back to the
Yes.
19th of February. So
Yes.
my post about this walk went with it, because I was thinking, I'm sure I posted some pictures. Where have they
And they're
gone?
gone.
There they were gone. But in the church, there's, well, the first thing that struck me was there were two books of common prayer, really old copies, just sort of left lying in the church, one of which was open, at the it was on the pulpit, and it was just opened at the sort of the one of the pages at the beginning, and it had an inscription from, says he, looking for it, from Alfred Morrison. So back to the family who own the estate now. And it just says presented to the church by Alfred Morrison, 24th of February 1854, and it was just lying there on the on the pulpit. And then there was another copy of the same book on the bench by the organ, together with a Bible, huge great Bible. And these are really really old books, and they're just lying there in the church, which I thought was very trusting of them.
Yeah, yeah.
But the other thing that struck me was that the marble monument. So as you're coming through the door, sort of almost opposite you, there's this very extravagant marble monument on the wall there, which is to Sir George Howe, who died in 1647. So there's a sort of a carving of Howe and his wife Dorothy, and they're caressing a skull, as you do.
Ooh.
And just below that, there are three other people who would have been their children, and there's a brass below the sculptures, below the sort of the likeness of the family, which a lot of it is sort of just worn away. It's very difficult to read, but I could make out the name Sir Harbottle Grimston. Now there's a name to conjure with. I think when I come back in my future life, I'm going to be called Sir Harbottle Grimston, because that's an incredible name. But he apparently was the daughter-in-law of one of Sir George's children, if that makes sense. No, it's George's daughter-in-law. Anyway, but so it just struck me that why they mentioned this particular person, Sir Harbottle Grimston. You know, why him? Bearing in mind he's, you know, he's somebody's father-in-law. But the other thing that I must admit, I'm struggling to remember where it was. Apparently, there's another monument in the church to the six children of Sir George's son. So we've got Sir George Howe, who died in 1647, who the memorial to. One of his children is also called, guess what, George. This is George Grobham Howe, who became an MP, and he had 11 children, six of whom died before or by the age of three. And there's a memorial in the church to these six children who died, which is terribly sad, isn't it, really?
Yeah, it is.
But I'm going to have to go back, because I don't remember seeing that memorial, but I was reading about it afterwards, and I thought, how did I miss that?
Yes, good excuse to go back and do the walk again.
Yeah.
I'm going to do this walk again in the summer, actually, because I can imagine on a hot summer's day it would be a nice walk to do. So coming out of the church and leaving Berwick St Leonard, you then head across. There's a footpath that takes you across fields towards Fonthill Bishop with some springs on your right-hand side. It's quite marshy there, isn't it?
Yeah, so you've got that. Basically, again, what struck me about that, it's a sort of water meadow. And either side of it, it looks, it's kind of like a flat level piece of meadow, and then sort of banked up on either side, to, you know, to contain the water. And I don't know if you noticed the little, stone bridge, just before you get to Fonthill Bishop.
Yes.
And there's sluices there. And the stone bridge was sort of really hidden away, and I think there's been a new bridge built around it. So you've got the sluice gates there. So what they would have done was they'd have closed the sluices and allow the water to back up, and then running sort of across the meadows. I was going to say perpendicular, or was it right angles? Can't remember which word I want there, but sort of right angles to the stream. You've got these drainage channels or irrigation channels going across the meadow and little drains down to the river. So as the water backed up, it would have pushed the water up these irrigation channels and then flooded into the fields. Obviously, sort of watering the grass. So it would have been incredibly rich pasture. Now the sluices are all, you know, they no longer used. That's clear. They've, you know, it's they're broken, but the remains are still there. There's this whole thing of sort of sluices. We see that a lot in Wiltshire and probably elsewhere, but it's something I always sort of look out for when I see those kind of meadows, as water meadows, sort of a form of agriculture and irrigation, which is just no longer used.
Yeah. So after that point, you go into the village of Fonthill Bishop, past the church, which isn't very welcoming to walkers.
No, it wasn't, was it?
Where it has the sign, "Don't wipe your muddy boots on our mat." But anyway, that was, church was locked anyway, so I couldn't go in that one.
Right.
So then, coming out of Fonthill Bishop, you go, the path that I took takes you path literally through the courtyard of the estate offices, up onto a bridleway that takes you up onto the hill, beyond, past Fonthill Clump and following a tree line, up into, until eventually you hit Little Ridge Wood, and as you're going up there are some nice views there. You can look back from the hill and see the lake in the distance, or you can look across the Chilmark. You know, there are some nice little viewpoints as you walk along through into the wood. I guess Little Ridge Wood might be the little brother of Great Ridge Wood, to the north.
I don't know. But of course, at one point the house, you know, the Fonthill estate house, one of the predecessors to the current house, was called Little Ridge.
Right. The house is at the bottom end of the wood anyway, at the moment, the Fonthill,
yes,
house. So I guess they must have, as you said, I think this is the sixth incarnation of it. So.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, as you exit the wood, you then hit this village of delightful little village called Ridge, where you then drop down, and the footpath takes you, leaving Ridge, along the Fonthill House Drive. You go through. I was a bit confused by this because you hit the gates, and you sort of get the impression that you're not welcome because it's the estate drive. But there is a gate to the side for the public footpath, so you are allowed to walk through. And then from there, before you get to the house, there's a path that drops you, starts to drop you down, then back towards the lake.
Yeah, it goes off left, doesn't it? Before that,
Yeah.
well before the house,
Well before the house, yeah.
the footpath goes off left next to a field where there's some, or between fields where there's horses grazing.
Yeah.
Because it's again, sort of Fonthill Estate is a big sort of equestrian, sort of say equestrian centre. But I think they've raised some very successful racehorses there. So yeah, horses is a big theme around there.
Yeah. And it's funny because as the I was following the footpath down back towards the lake, past Ashley Wood, through a field system where you can look across and see this tree line called the Bushes. The paths were very well marked, and it was very clear where you were allowed to walk and where you weren't allowed to walk.
Yeah.
Like in Ashley Wood, there didn't seem to be any footpaths going into that. It was quite clearly marked as private. And I think looking at the aerial maps afterwards, there's actually a house in the middle of that wood, where somebody lives. So I don't know what the story is behind that.
Yeah, if I'm still with you, so as you come down the drive and you branch off left between those two
Yes.
fields, it's just up that path there. Is that what you mean? And then
Yes.
off to your left, yeah. So there was a house in the woods there.
Yeah,
Yeah, we
that's right.
saw Julia and I saw quite an elderly lady sort of drive out of there.
Right.
I think it's just a couple of cottages or one
Yeah,
cottage.
yeah.
Lovely spot, sort of tucked away in the woods. So I would
Yeah.
imagine it's one of the, because they do rent cottages out on the estate.
Right.
And she sort of drove out there, and then and she drove up to the main house.
Oh,
So
that's fascinating.
don't know, you know what the connection there was, but yeah,
Yeah.
she looks like she was living there.
Yeah, and eventually the path brings you out right at the bottom end of Fonthill Lake, where you can see there's kind of a weir and a hydroelectric power system and things like that, which is used to power part of the estate. There are some signs and stuff you can read about what's going on there. But it was a short walk from there right back to the beginning of where I'd parked my car. But as I was sort of making my way back to the car, I was thinking, it was a really nice, interesting walk. It wasn't didn't feel like many other Wiltshire walks that we've done. It felt very unique, very manicured. It was
Very
quite,
artificial, I thought, the countryside there.
yeah. There is that to it. It's different, but parts of it very picturesque
Oh, yeah.
and well worth a look. And as I say, it's one walk I think I'd like to do on a quite a warm, sunny summer's day. Just to see how different it made the landscape look, because when I did it, it was quite a grey day, and quite damp. But yeah, still worth doing. And yeah, it introduced me to a part of Wiltshire I'd never really explored.
And a whole bunch of stories
And the
that I wasn't
stories,
aware of
goodness
either.
me, goodness me. And it was interesting to get that link between, Fonthill and the Beckford gentleman, William Beckford, and his links to that tower in Bath, which I'd seen before but never
Yeah.
knew about the connection with Fonthill. It's fascinating to have those local connections. So,
Yeah.
yeah, great walk.
Yeah, very interesting.
Okay, so I think that's it for this week on Fonthill, and now we can look ahead to the next podcast, which I mentioned earlier we were going to do in the south of the county, down towards Kitzgrave and the Chalk Valley. Where I did that walk quite recently, and you did it last year, and that's up on the website. But we'll go into that in a bit more detail next week. So I guess it's down to the final usual sign-off
Yes,
things.
the thank yous and what have you. So the usual reminder about the lower boots or Lowa, Lowa offer. They're still giving us 20% discount. I know they've sold a few more pairs recently, including to you. Glyn. I gather you bought
Yeah,
a pair.
I got some walking shoes. Bargain.
So go onto the website, pick up a pair of their walking boots or shoes, and put in the discount code HW for Hidden Wiltshire 20HW20 for a 20% discount. Reminder about the website and the show notes, where we put all sorts of useful links and things in there. So that's on the Hidden Wiltshire website, the usual address. And last but not least, thank you again to Steve Dixon for the music. So the bit in the middle, the transition bit into the walk is Steve recorded this I think a couple of years ago, but it just seems so well, not so appropriate, but it really caught my eye. It's actually called Dark and Lonely Water. So, not that we're suggesting that Fonthill Lake is dark and lonely, but it just seemed to work. So thank you, Steve.
Yeah, that seemed appropriate. Thanks, Steve, who's this kind of hidden member of the team.
Yeah.
But yeah, we're enjoying working our way through his music as we go. So we'll catch up again in 2 weeks' time.
Bye for now.
Bye.